You're listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. Interesting conversations about innovation, economics, culture, and history for the independent thinkers and curious minds. I'm your host, Alex Wolf. Hi, and welcome to this episode of the Alex Wolf Podcast. I am happy you're here, of course. Grateful as always, and have been really appreciating your messages and just feeling bonded with you guys through this magic medium of the internet. So, all right, this episode, I want to talk about living for an output versus living for no output and how that changes our lives, and why so many of us are focused on living lives purely based on making an output. So I'll break that down in more detail. But basically, why I care about this is because I kind of tried living without a goal for a while, or just like goals. And people thought I was crazy, like especially in the entrepreneurship world, like people eat, sleep, and shit goals. Like everyone's talking about their goals, and it is the North Star for so many of our lives. But at the time, I wasn't motivated by goals. I was actually, and kind of still, I'm not crazy or thrilled about goals. I think they're helpful and useful, but I don't really find too much value surrounding or basing my life on goals. So, and I think I got there because I had spent so many years obsessed with meeting goals. Like I said, being in the entrepreneur world, being just hyper ambitious and desperate for approval and success as an early 20-year-old or in my early 20s, I just was kind of jaded. And after a while, I was like, is there something else? Like, I don't want to just go from one goal to one goal. So, you know, I had goals about my weight. I had business goals. I had just a lot of calculable, measurable, you know, things that were hovering over me, and they were just really aggressive goals that would not allow me to relax. And after a while, I sort of caught on to the fact that, you know, none of these goals are gonna help me enjoy life between each of the goals, or like how I like to say it is, you know, how they say it's important you read between the lines. It's the same kind of thing. It's important to live life between the goals, and it's just too easy to not care about that. So that's what I wanted to talk about today, and I think that journey has just led me to be so much more sensitive about, you know, what should we be doing between, you know, those goals, or how do we read between the lines of our lives. And I think one of the main things that I've learned is that there's a difference between reaching a goal and living a quote-unquote goal. So I'll repeat that. There's a difference between reaching a goal and living a goal. So for me, reaching a goal is about the mountaintop. It's about the moment that you get the thing, and it is rewarding, but as we know, it can be very temporary, and it's also kind of misleading because you might get the accomplishment and think that you have, you know, you now have access to unlimited happiness or whatever. And I also think that one of the things I was not aware of, because nobody told me, is that you can reach goals, but it will feel horrible. I'm talking about successful, you know, awards or accomplishments or even tiny goals, right? But the type of goals that make people jealous, right? What no one told me is that reaching those goals over and over again don't even feel good, and actually can feel bad and horrible in my experience, unless you've managed to arrange a few friendships or bonds with people who can be genuinely happy for you, okay? Because if not, it's only further isolating. So here I was, early 20s, like, oh, I'm gonna be the best, and you know, we're almost taught to want to get people angry and jealous and envious. So here I am thinking, okay, I'm gonna be number one, and that's gonna, I don't know, again, I there's a vague promise that that is going to give you immunity to any like sadness, which again, in my experience, it only caused sadness. And I've had so many experiences, too many, of reaching a goal and not feeling like I can properly celebrate it, feeling like it's only further isolating me from feeling real friendships or connections with other people. So that was my experience. And looking around, I felt like that was the experience of others. And I'm not anti-goal. I'm not anti, you know, going to the mountaintop. I'm more just pro being realistic about what the hell is up there before you get misled like me. So the difference, yeah, so that's reaching a goal. Now, living a goal requires, it's very different because there's no mountaintop. Living a quote-unquote goal, I feel like there's a better word for that in this particular context, but living a goal requires no output. It requires no explanation. And this is my favorite part, it requires no expertise. So let me break down what I'm saying. It's the difference between saying, oh, I'm gonna learn how to play a guitar, and feeling like you have to become an expert in you know, how to play the guitar. You feel like you got to buy the best guitar equipment. You got to go broke, you know, buying the most fancy guitar lessons. Like you go a little nuts, right? So that's not living a goal. That is trying to reach a goal, or I think just applying too much pressure to something that doesn't need so much structure. So the difference about living a goal is just is saying something more along the lines of I'm going to learn how to play the guitar and just have fun with it. I'm not going to feel like I have to become an expert just to have permission to touch the guitar. And so many of us do that. We feel like, oh, well, I like this, but, you know, before I even admit to anyone that I like it, including myself, let me take 5 million, you know, let me put 5 million obstacles in front of the way before I give myself permission to just enjoy this. So living the goal is just, is saying, I just want to play the guitar to have fun because it gives me joy. I'm not trying to get anything out of it, but the experience itself. No output. I don't care if the song isn't like Jimi Hendrix. I don't care if the guitar is average and has, you know, isn't the most fancy guitar in the world. I just, it's calling me and I want to touch it and I want to play the strings. And I feel like I had a similar experience with paint. You know, it's like, I just wanted to paint. And there was a part of me that was like, well, Alex, you can't, you're not a painter. You know, what do you think this is? You know, it's just like, and for what? Like, you can start painting right away. So that's the difference. I think when we're so focused on reaching goals, we put so much pressure on things that could just be something we're trying to experience for no output. And like I said, living a goal requires no output, no explanation, and no expertise. So, you know, again, you got to be careful about who you have around you, or be confident about how to communicate with someone who might hear that you want to play a guitar and go into interrogation mode. Oh, is that what you're doing now? Oh, what made you want to get into this? Do you know how to play? And all those things. And what they're doing is they're asking for an explanation, and living a goal requires no explanation. So I think a lot of, again, our insecurity comes from, how am I going to explain this? If I buy the paint, you know, how am I going to explain to my friends or people why I'm allowed to have the paint in my house? Well, here's the kicker. It doesn't matter. You're allowed to have it because you want to enjoy it for the literal experience of it, and that's it. And that's okay. So it's just, it's so simple, and it's such a no-brainer, but in my experience, and I'm sure you've probably had experience as well, it's like there's this psychological wall that is getting in the way of that. So, another place I noticed this a lot was in the park. I go to the park, you know, to just literally enjoy it. I love to stare at the water. I know if you're listening to this, you're into that too. And just literally enjoy the experience. But, and what I love too is I've done a lot of reading on like parks, and particularly Frederick Olmsted, who was a park designer who I love and super inspired by. And, you know, back in the days, people would go to the park and they'd like get dressed up in like nice clothes just to literally stroll and bask in the beauty of nature. Frederick Olmsted was the creator of Central Park and Prospect Park in New York City, and he designed many of the national parks across the country. And he had a deep-rooted philosophy that people who live in urban spaces should have natural landscapes to bring harmony and sort of ground them to, I guess, life, because cities, as you know, can get kind of abstract and kind of take you out of reality. And obviously, I mean, that's shit I love. So I'm a big fan of his. And so when I look at these photos and I look at how this relationship with the park has changed over the years, and, you know, I also think about being a kid and how I don't know who I would be as a person if I didn't have a park to play in. And the fact that someone had to intentionally say, hey, we need to create these environments. You guys know how I am about environments. Environments dictate behavior more than rules, more than people telling other people what to do. So by creating these healthy environments for us as adults, and especially as children as well, I mean, I'm so grateful. And I don't know, that's all I can really say about that. But today, you know, if you go to the park, I don't know about your experience, but for me, people aren't like dressed in their nice clothes. They're usually just wearing like sweaty workout clothes, and they use the park as a gym or a bathroom for their dog. And I'm you know me, I'm kind of picky and bougie, and like I'll be sitting there and I can see in my peripheral people jogging and you know, dog walking, which for the most part doesn't bother me, but I would be lying if I didn't admit that I think about like, wow, I wonder how this park felt when people would just come here to enjoy it. Now, I'm not saying no one goes to the park to enjoy it. Absolutely not. People definitely are there and they lay down. And honestly, I've noticed more of that since the pandemic than before. Because I think, you know, obviously this year has made us reevaluate everything and people are like, oh, hey, like, I just want to enjoy the park. But it was just an observation. And just the running and the exercising, I get it. I'm not trying to shame. I just want to highlight this observation of going to the park to just experience the park versus going for this output. Because everyone, you know, was running right through it like they can't wait to get the hell out of there. It's like, you're coming to the park to just run out of it? Okay. It is what it is. Whatever. So I pulled up a little diary note that I made in the park that I posted a while ago, but it's relevant. I said, even just being in the park, each person is determinant on producing some sort of output as if they were a computer. To just enjoy the park would be absurd. One must instead have a device attached tracking each movement, or at least a dog to walk to give them permission to be here. The landscape of sunbathed flowers and a glittering lake seems to be unfit for a stroll. No, they must run straight through it like they do with life itself. So that's me being the judgy philosopher. Everyone's minding their business. But it's something that means, as someone who cares about technology, of course, I'm always looking at behaviors that are, you know, resembling to our tech. And I think that, you know, it takes a certain mindset to create a computer, but a computer also has an influence on our mindset. And I was really just kind of off put with how much I think we want to produce outputs. I mean, that's the best way to put it. That brings me to my next point, which is, how did we get so output-y, for lack of a better word? You know, how And is being that output focused bad? Are we destroying ourselves by doing that? I think personally that caring about output is not only super important, but necessary to have a decent society. I want to say that because as much as I think prioritizing it can do harm to our experience of life, it is, I think, a necessity if you want to benefit from having a society. And I think that what requires you to produce output is those inherent responsibilities that come with civilization, that come with civility, and all the benefits that it brings. But I think also to reap the rewards of this, we have to understand that we're all depending on everybody to create an output so that we can get something out of the civilization. Does that make sense? So basically, in my point of view, civilizations are groups of people who are creating outputs, and that through this collective of the outputs, we get to benefit from having a civilization. So to give you examples, so it's not too abstract, outputs can be things like literally just children, you know, for population and for family, for companionship. Outputs can be things like wealth. And obviously, just so you guys know, I distinguish wealth from money. So wealth is the actual value, mostly a tangible value when I talk about wealth. So I'm talking about water and seeds for food and like actual natural resources. So obviously whoever can produce an output of wealth, whether it be the farmer or someone who's really good, a blacksmith, this is like ancient times, but just to give you like a basic example, someone who can do alchemy on natural elements and create wealth out of that, or has the natural elements and can sell those to someone else who can make alchemy, like make a iPhone out of glass and crystals and stuff like that. So that's an example of output. And for wealth, we need wealth for obviously survival, and I like to call it thrivival, just, you know, the level above surviving and actually living to enjoy life. Another example of an output that we're kind of pressured and required to create is money, of course. And money, again, I distinguish it from wealth because we use money to trade the wealth. And what the money is doing is it's acting as a currency to provide, to facilitate and simplify the trade and the wealth generation. So we use money to create concepts like credit and insurance and things like that. So we kind of create, like fake wealth to stimulate real wealth. So, for example, if a farmer wants a loan, then we use money and we give that farmer, you know, credit, and then they use that credit to actually plant seeds that make actual food, which is actual wealth. That's the way money, you know, I think is the healthiest when it comes to credit. But obviously, we can talk about that another day, because a lot of people get credit and then they don't generate any wealth from it, and then the economy collapses. Another day, another example of an output are accomplishments that reflect valuable skills. So these are why, you know, this is why people are obsessed about degrees and promotions and awards, because in a fair world, these accomplishments should be reflecting skills that are valued, desired, and needed in an economy. So, you know, right now it's a very valuable skill to know how to market, because there's a bunch of shit to sell and we have to keep selling to keep the economy going. So that's an output. So an overview, like I said, it's children, it's wealth, it's money, it's accomplishments. And so civilization is the pressure that is, you know, saying, okay, what are you doing here? Get up, go, you know, go be productive, make something happen, because you're not allowed to just lay back in a civilization and gain off of everybody else's output, and you aren't contributing in some way, shape, or form. So there's pros and there's cons. I mean, I think there's things about that is cool, and obviously I think, you know, it can get to a point where it's overload. And as important as these things are for making the world go round, obviously humans also crave and gravitate towards activities that have no output, you know, similar to the principle of entertainment that I talked about in the last episode, which is things that activities that have no out that we do for no output are dancing, listening to music. You're not listening to music because there's a little treat when the song finishes. You're listening to music because you're enjoying the song, and when the song ends, that's actually when the joy ends. Versus when you think about school, you go to school because there's a little treat at the end of the school, your degree or your accomplishment or whatever. Obviously another media or activity that provides no output is art. Just the joy of making art is the joy of making art. If you're making art to get a little treat after you're finished, then you're not, you know, it's not the art itself that's giving you the satisfaction, and joy. So I guess, you know, I'm saying all this to maybe stimulate for you and ask you, what do you do for no output? And have you thought about it? What are you naturally doing for no output? And are you really focused on outputs? Are you one of those people who want to always have an experience that has a trinket at the end or an accomplishment at the end or some kind of measurable unit that expresses the activity that you did? Or is the activity itself enough? The other thing I wanted to say is that there is a difference between using, I love the word use, by the way, and I'll break that down. There is a difference between using life for life and using life for death. I'll repeat that and break it down. There is a difference between using life for life and using life for death. Now, using life or death sounds a little grim. It's not meant to be. It's really just the part of us that wants to use life to leave a legacy, and the part of us that feels an obligation to our community to, again, have that legacy. Legacy is all about who are you when you're dead. And it's also the part of us that wants to immortalize parts of who we are, whether it be through our wealth or our art or whatever contribution, because we want our lives to be so useful that they can extend their usefulness beyond us being alive. And I think that, again, most of us feel pressure to use our life for death, to use our life to say, hey, I came here and I, you know, threw down, I did this and I got this and I help with this, so my time here, you know, benefited others and they get to benefit from this today. So using life or death is that part, and I don't think it's inferior or superior. It's just I'm making note of the difference. Now, using life for life is using this mysterious phenomenon of existence simply to experience. Using life for life is, you know, marveling at greens and yellows. It's experiencing the orgasmic dimensions of food and temperature and texture. It's experiencing the intensity of joy and sorrow. It is the human experience, right? And artists tend to be okay with living off of the thrill and entertainment of the human experience, both the good and the bad. You know, artists love a good heartbreak, love a good anger session. And that's because they love feeling the range of emotion and experience that the heart and mind can feel. And that's why they're notorious for being at odds with society most of the time and at odds with the status quo. Because again, society and status quo wants that output. You know, what did you do today? You went to the park and you didn't run? Wait, you went to the park and you ran 1 mile, you didn't run two? Again, that's not, it's not a real voice, but it's a pressure I think that we feel just by a way of being in a culture that is constantly trying to track what the hell you have to offer to the civilization. And what you, not only what you have to offer as a I think, like, naturally, but what you have to offer on, like, kind of a machine-like level. So, because you can have, for me, I feel like a mother's love, right, is a huge, has huge output potential, but it's not really something we measure or keep track of. And for the love of God, we should not. I don't want to put that idea in anyone's head. But those are the beautiful subtleties of the human experience. And it is, I think, about contributing both and figuring out how to do both and what to prioritize. So I say all this to say that, you know, people use their lives very differently. And again, I want to emphasize, I don't think one is better than the other. I really think it depends on the individual and what makes them feel like life is worth living. So again, there's a difference between using life for life and using life for death. And I love the word use because it redefined the word abuse or abuse, right? For me, which was a big wake up call. The prefix ab means a way or separation. So you think about like abnormal or abstract. Abuse is about straying away from proper use, proper usage. So it gives more depth to things like, you know, someone abusing alcohol or someone abusing you. They are abusing you, right? Using you for the wrong thing. They've strayed away from what your relationship should be used for. And again, you can use life for life, or you can use life for death. And I love looking at the word use that way, especially the word abuse that way, because I think of how many of us abuse our lives, how many of us abuse our time, our energy. We often use it for things we think we should be doing or think we should be using it for, and don't really know or do enough, you know, exploration to really figure out what is the best way to use my life instead of abuse my life. So again, I think everyone is responsible for coming up for their own plan for this, and what makes their life feel worth living. I know for me, life feels most worth living when I use life for life first. So, you know, again, for the experience of life, I love to just enjoy having receptive, sensitive senses to see, to taste, to touch. And output is important to me, clearly, but it does come second. And I don't base my worth off of, or my life's worth on my output. And that's what works for me. I've tried all different things, but that's what works for me. And again, just turning questions on you now, I think one of my favorite questions is how will you measure your life? There's a Rent song called Seasons of Love. Rent is a Broadway play. You either love it or hate it. I love it, especially as a teenager, saw it live. But anyway, we're not here to talk about the play. There's a song called Seasons of Love. You probably have heard the song, it's pretty popular. And the first line is 525,600 minutes. And that's a lot of minutes, and it's supposed to represent how many minutes are in a life. And the question they ask, or the questions they ask are, how will you measure a year? I guess that's how many minutes are in a year. So they ask, you know, in daylights, in sunsets, in midnights, in cups of coffee, in inches, in miles, in laughter and strife. Thank you for accepting my voice. Okay, so it's basically posing this question to the listener to pick a unit of measurement that properly reflects how you want to measure your life, which I love. In cups of coffee. That's so poetic. I love it. I know the people who hate Rent are like cringing right now, but you know, gotta deal with it. So yeah, this question, how will you measure your life, is so great. It's also the name of a book that I will link to. It's a book by a man who actually recently died, which gives this whole like conversation more depth because it's about life and death. And he recently died right before the pandemic happened. And he was actually a big inspiration to Steve Jobs. His name was Clay Christensen. And he had a lot of really prophetic things to say about business, innovation, and really also how to use versus abuse your life. And he saw these correlations between how people fail businesses and how much that's correlated to how people, quote unquote, fail their lives. So I'll wrap up this episode by reading out what I wrote about the book a while back. And I said, Clay Christensen wrote one of the most famous business books, The Innovator's Dilemma, which is apparently what Steve Jobs read before he launched the iPod and iPhone, two obviously very revolutionary innovations for Apple. But years later, Christensen wrote another book called How Will You Measure Your Life? Explaining that the same thing that makes businesses fail is the same things that make our lives fail, which is essentially being fooled by the sensation of instant gratification as progress. The biggest companies don't fail because they're poorly managed. They fail because they are so well managed, no one there is paying attention to the little details that will make up the future, and before you know it, it's too late. The same thing happens to our lives when we focus on knocking things off our to-do list and advancing our careers, because those give us quick, trackable evidence that we're doing something quote-unquote right, but the parts of life that are less easy to feel quick gratification from, that are less easy to track, like committing to a relationship or being present with your children, those little details that make up the future get pushed aside, and before you know it, it's too late. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please let me know what you thought. Send me a message on Twitter or Instagram. This is stuff that I really enjoy talking about, obviously. And yeah, I will see you in the next episode. Have a good week. Thank you for listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And if you aren't already, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more resources on innovation, economics, and culture, visit alexwolf.co/newsletter and sign up for my email list. Thanks.